You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, testifying before Congress today. AIG CEO Edward Liddy acknowledged, quote, the patience of American taxpayers is wearing thin. But he stressed the need for forbearance and solidarity, quote, we are all in this together, said Liddy. Meanwhile, the people who destroyed the economy at AIG are receiving $165 million, while the company has already received $170 billion. The bonuses, I guess, for the destruction and suffering their work has caused millions of Americans. In one moment, we're going to be joined by Catherine Austin Fitz to talk about Liddy's testimony today and his claims that these contracts for $165 million in bonuses are too complicated to be broken. But let's listen to an excerpt of his gobbledygook on the subject. Listen to this.
We are essentially operating AIG on behalf of the American taxpayer so that we can maximize the amount we pay back to the government as quickly as possible. We weigh every decision we make with one priority in mind. Will this action help our ability to pay monies back to the government or hurt it? Although we have wound down more than $1 trillion in the portfolio of AIG financial products, roughly a third from its peak, the unit that is at the root of our financial problems, that portfolio remains very large, $1.6 trillion, and it continues to contain substantial risk. The financial downside for taxpayers is potentially very large, and it's very real. And that's why we're winding down that business as quickly as possible. To prevent undue risk exposure in the meantime, AIG has made a set of retention payments to employees based upon a compensation system that prior management put in place at the end of 2007 and the beginning of 2008. Payments were made to employees in the financial products unit that caused many of AIG's problems. And Americans are asking quite simply, why pay these people anything at all? Here's why. I'm trying desperately to prevent an uncontrolled collapse of that business. This is the only way to improve AIG's ability to pay taxpayers back quickly and completely, and the only way to avoid a systemic shock to the economy that the U.S. government help was meant to relieve.
Well, Edward Liddy of AIG went on to say, quote, mistakes were made at AIG on a scale that few could have imagined possible. Well, this gives new meaning to mistakes, Catherine Austin Fitz. And, of course, he said these contracts that were made by the criminal conspiracy before he came to power cannot be broken. And he said in another statement in his testimony today, these are not one sort of common contract. Each contract that they have with each one of these banking bandits is individual, so they just can't break them all at once. Your response?
Well, they do have contracts, and under the law, I'm assuming they're required to keep those contracts. However, there's a long history by AIG, because they breached a contract that I had with them. And they had no problem breaching their contract. They seem to do it all the time. So whether it's AIG or whether it's the government, there's been a long history of breaching or abrogating contracts when it was convenient and not breaching or abrogating when it was not convenient. So if they're choosing to honor the contracts in this instance, they're doing it probably, Dennis, for two reasons. One is they can't afford for people to walk out. And two, the people who were handling the derivatives, I'm sure, were doing what they were told. And the reality is, when you abrogate or breach a contract on somebody who was doing what they were told to do, then they're going to go to court and they're going to make clear in written court documents about specifically what it was they were ordered to.
No, wait. So, like, if I could translate, are you saying $165 million in hush money?
$165 million paid to do what you, to honor contracts. I hire a hitman. Okay, the hitman goes out and engages in financial assassinations as ordered. the hitman has a contract to do that. I'm now honor-bound to pay that contract. If I don't, the hitman will go to court and bring out all the information of what it was exactly he was ordered to do. The other thing is they want those guys to stay. They don't want them
to... All right, and that's the other... So they want the people who busted Wall Street to stay on and what? Do it again? We need them to do it again?
No, but here's what you need to understand. AIG is not the one who busted Wall Street. Let's look at how these trades work. Let's look at those derivative traders in London who are getting the
bonus. Okay, so this is what they were doing.
Okay, so Goldman Sachs in New York engages in fraudulent inducement, okay? They're part of a syndicate that lends money out to people in poor communities who can't afford it. You know, they push fraudulent inducement. It's illegal. They put together pools of paper, which they know to be not what they're represented. They sell them to a big European bank who's willing to buy them because AIG guarantees the creditworthiness of it. Okay, so the European bank is willing to go along with the fraud because AIG basically says, don't worry about it. If there's a problem, we'll take care of it.
So they're using AIG's good credit rating to do the scam.
Well, but remember what's going on here. We're basically using AIG to get money back to Goldman Sachs so that Goldman Sachs can get out of jail free. In other words, they can engage in fraudulent inducement and destroy neighborhoods throughout America. And they can purposely push paper that they know is worthless or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They can engage in all these frauds, and then they can engineer to get covered when it results in losses by basically having the Treasury and the Fed bail out AIG.
Okay, does anybody remember who Elliot Spitzer was, what his former position was?
I do.
For a few minutes. Right, he was the governor of New York.
Right.
And he wrote a little financial thing about subprime and securitization, and he got in trouble. He wrote another article, didn't he? And he sort of enlarges the picture.
Right. Elliot Spitzer had a great article that he published, I think it was today, and he basically said, forget about the bonuses. That's the side distraction. Let's look at the billions of dollars that are going to AIG, who's turning around and paying it out to somebody else. Where's that money going? And, you know, and he nails Goldman Sachs. And my guess is, you know, AIG is being the if you will, the front man and the fall guy to protect a lot of people. And it wouldn't surprise me. The you know, all the indications in the reports are probably the biggest one is Goldman Sachs. I just finished looking at their annual report, Dennis. Goldman Sachs, at the end of November 2008, it was the end of their fiscal year, had $122 billion in cash and cash equivalents sitting on their balance sheet. Does that sound like a firm that needs to be bailed out of its frauds?
I don't understand. I'm sorry.
It's called financial coup d'etat.
All right, back to this unit in London.
Uh-huh.
Again, tell us again a different way. What were they doing?
What they were doing was making it easy. If somebody wanted to buy these mortgage pools and didn't want to worry about whether or not the mortgages were good or there were really houses behind the mortgages, they didn't want to worry about the creditworthiness of the pools, they would just have AIG do one of these swaps, which ensured that they were looking to AIG. If there was a default, it wasn't their problem. If it turned out that there were no homes and there were no mortgage payments, if everything defaulted, then they were looking to AIG.
All right. And
so AIG is in effect guaranteeing the credit.
Now, how many people do you suppose were engaged in this operation? How many institutions? How would this scam operation work? Which way would it go? Who would know about it?
Well, the process was designed so that at every step you could say you didn't know. So if you're sitting on the swap desk and the derivative desk in London at AIG, you can say you don't know that the pools are fraudulently created. If you're sitting at the mortgage desk at Goldman Sachs in New York, you can say, Well, I've never been to Chicago. I don't, you know, I didn't know that the people in that neighborhood couldn't afford these mortgages, and I don't know where the mortgages come from. So, you know, there's all sorts of people on the line who have plausible deniability. And the European bank can say, well, I don't know anything about the housing mortgage market because I'm just looking to AIG. But if you look through the, you know, through all the excuses, and you just said to me, okay, well, you know, you were lead financial advisor to HUD during, you know, when this all got started, and you were working with all these big companies. You know, I was working with Goldman, I was working with AIG. How many people knew that this was a pump and dump that was fraudulent in intention? I mean, that America was systematically being raped. I would say it was thousands at the highest level. The senior executives of all these firms, of all the big financial institutions knew. They knew this was fraudulent.
Right, so it wasn't a lone gun operation.
No, the guys in London were not lone guns whatsoever. And if you look at the history of AIG and what AIG was doing as a business, I mean, this is a firm which is infamous for involvement in the covert side of the U.S. government and covert activities, you know, in the financial area. So there's no way, I mean, this there's no firm more sophisticated in what's really going on in the world than AIG.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio every Wednesday on Flashpoint. It's Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. She is our translator from Wall Street to Main Street. She's a former high-level official in the first Bush administration, Assistant Secretary of Housing, former Wall Street banker, was engaged by the government for many years, shall we say, engaged for trying to take them head on a lot of different levels and save taxpayers millions of dollars. Now she speaks to us about, among other things, how to keep resources in the community and keep our community strong that way. That's what we call the segment Community Business. Now, speaking of trying to keep our resources in the community, Catherine, the Federal Reserve ramped up its efforts to resuscitate supposedly the sagging economy, saying that it's going to purchase up to $300 billion of long-term U.S. Treasury securities in the next few months. Is that printing money? Is that another way of saying they're printing more money?
Yes. They're printing more money. I called someone in Berkeley last Thursday night, and they picked up the phone and sounded very sad. I said, what's the matter? And they said, you know, I just got back from the grocery store. The loaf of bread I wanted to buy was $5. A month ago, it was $3.50. Now, what the Federal Reserve just announced was they are expanding the money supply, but doing it in a way that the new money created will again go to the insiders. But what's going to happen is it's the long-term effect is to raise prices for everybody else. Now, if you sat down and looked through all the gobbledygook of what the Fed has been saying over the last 2 years, the way they hope to keep prices down is by keeping the price of labor down. Now, the problem with that is if our incomes are falling, that will offset some inflation, but it means we can't afford to buy $5 bread.
And now, and I was listening to some of the other public radio and television shows, and I think it was on the Lira Report. I don't know where I heard it, but one of the experts was saying, was asked, does this mean, if they print $300 billion, does this mean the, say, $10,000 I have in my bank account is now worth $5? Well, what does it mean?
Well, if you look between January 1st, 2003, and January 1st, 2008, if you had had a dollar in the bank or a dollar in a bank CD or a dollar in a treasury security, during that five-year period, your purchasing power when measured in gallons of gasoline dropped by 50%. That's what I call the slow burn. So what was happening was as more money was being printed, the value of what you could buy with your dollar. So for every dollar you had in the bank, you lost half. Okay, so at the end of that period, if you'd had $10,000 in the bank for that 5 years, you lost the equivalent in purchasing power of $10,000. Now, what has been happening with the bailouts, because the bailouts are now, depending on how you count them, up to $12 to $14 trillion. What is happening is you're printing a huge amount of money. You're putting it into players like Goldman Sachs. That's why they have $122 billion of cash on their balance sheet. So selected players are getting protected, but then the rest of, you know, everyone else has their existing money, their existing paper money, or any of their dollar fixed incomes. It's the value of that in terms of purchasing power is diminishing steadily. And Dennis, it's not just here in the United States. We're seeing all around the world. People, you know, governments that have what's called fiat currency or paper currency, engaging in stimulus and printing more and more, and pressure on those who don't. We saw tremendous pressure on the Swiss, who finally last week announced that they too were going to buy debt, and we saw their currency drop. So, after the announcement today, gold was up tremendously. Gold's just a form, you know, an alternative currency and one way of looking at what is going on in the other fiat currencies. But we're seeing, you know, we're seeing the fiat currencies drop against the value of precious metals and any assets that are holding their value.
All right. And so in terms of people, I mean, can't you imagine that many people are going to go out and buy these bonds? Say people, somebody has that $10,000 in the bank and they think, well, this would be a great way to save money and make a little interest. I'll go buy some of these bonds.
Well, probably the best investment that anyone can make right now is in doing those things which permanently reduce your expenses. So the more you can withdraw from a fiat currency system, the safer you are. So, for example, I once told you about I had a friend whose water bill was rising, but was living in the country so she could build a well. And I said, it's real simple. Stop worrying that your dividends are falling or your CD interests are falling. Just, you know, so she did that, and now she permanently has deleted the water bill from her life for people paying down debt. Anything you can do to make alternative arrangements for the strategic resources you need, food, water, clothing, whatever, anything you can do to permanently reduce your overhead and expenses in this kind of environment is typically the best investment. And the other thing is, you know, I steadily now, anything that I or my business uses, I try and maintain a 2-year inventory. Because if you look at the speed at which real things, tangible assets, are rising in price, and how much they could, because right now we're still working our way off of enormous consumer bubble. But as the manufacturing capacity ramps down and the distribution capacity ramps down, we could see real hiccups real jumps in prices and real hiccups in supply.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are talking about very crucial aspects of the economy. I'm going to come back now to the AIG in this way, Catherine. So, in a way, we could say that just about the only thing we really know about all the bailout, billions in bailout money, where it went, we at least know that $165 million went to bonuses.
Well, I must tell you, Dennis, if you look at the bonuses being paid out by the Wall Street firms that are getting paid back through AIG, the bonuses being paid out of this $12 trillion is much bigger than $165
million. All right, go over that. Getting paid back by AIG. AIG engaged with major intelligence agencies. What? You got to do it again, Kevin. I'm sorry. What is the role of AIG in the context of Goldman Sachs and all these other Wall Street operations?
Okay, so let's say I originate a whole bunch of mortgages in a poor community, so the subprime mortgages. And these mortgages have no business being originated in the first place. Or let's say I have collateral fraud. In other words, there's more mortgage, you know, I've got three mortgages on every house, and you and I have talked a lot about the why I believe there's significant collateral fraud. I take them and I put them in a pool, it's a mortgage-backed security, and I sell them. Now, the European or Asian bank buys them, they don't want to look into and think about whether these mortgages are real or not. So they depend, you know, what I do is I get someone like AIG to do a credit guarantee on it. So basically, they don't need to worry about...
Right, they do, they're the insurance company, but how do they now, in the context of the bailout, are they... Is it their responsibility to funnel money back to these?
Right. So what happens is this mortgage pool stops making the mortgage payments. So the European bank turns to AIG and says, look, I want you guys, you know, this is not my problem. This is your problem. I want you to pay me. And AIG says, oh my goodness, this is going to cost billions and billions of dollars. I've got a problem. Now, you know, in a normal circumstance, AIG would pay the European bank and then turn around to Goldman Sachs and say, wait, these mortgages are fraudulent. You engaged in a fraud. This is not our problem. This is your problem. You have to take some of your $122 billion of cash, and you need to make good on the fact that we lost money helping you rape this neighborhood. Okay? But rather than doing that, rather than putting it back to Goldman Sachs, instead, we're putting it back to the Treasury. The Treasury is producing the money to make sure AIG can pay the European bank, and Goldman Sachs can sit there and not worry.
So they're the, in a way, they're the corporate bag man.
They're the beneficiary of this. And it's not just Goldman Sachs. I'm assuming.
No, but I mean, AIG is the corporate bag man. AIG is the delivery.
Right, in one sense. In one sense, AIG is dealing with the dirty parts.
All right. We just have a minute left, and we literally only have a minute left. But a lot of people were asking about something you said, so please take the last minute. Did you say on this program last week that you believe in your dealings with the government that there were attempts to poison you, multiple attempts?
Oh, no. I know. I mean, I have...
You know this.
I have the tests. Yeah, sure. To get rid of the poison, I had to do all the testing. And if you look at the toxicity levels of arsenic, lead, and some of the other poisonings, it's, you know, it's off the chart. So, no, I know. I mean, I was there. It's kind of like saying, did you know you went to your senior prom? Yeah, I did, because I was there, and I had a pink dress, and I danced. So, yeah, no, I mean, I know I was poisoned, because it's... When you're badly poisoned, Dennis, you don't miss the symptoms. It's you know, particularly on something like arsenic, they're very distinct symptoms. But then when you do the test, I mean, the real proof is, do you have so much, for example, arsenic in your system that there's no other explanation than you were poisoned? But yeah, I'm sure I'm poisoned.
All right, let me jump in there. Solari.com/blog if people want to communicate with you. Have you written about that on your blog?
No, because okay. You know, I'm much more interested
right. I understand, but people are interested in that as well. Catherine
yeah.
Austin Fitz, again, Solari.com/blog. You want to communicate with Catherine every week. It's Community Business on Wednesdays, usually with Catherine Austin Fitz. And Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the economy, and as news breaks, at AIG of even more corporate bonuses by bailed out financial firms, public anger spills into the streets. According to SEIU, 10,000 people are expected to protest at major U.S. banks and firms, including AIG, Bank of America, and Citigroup, talking about protests around the country, Chicago, Denver, Boston, Portland, San Francisco, New York, and Washington, D.C. Joining us to talk about this anger now spilling over into the streets, apparently, is Stephen Lerner. He's the assistant to the president of SEIU. Mr. Lerner, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Good to have you with us. First of all, your initial reaction, now we can't curse on the air here, but when you heard that AIG had no choice, they were legally obligated to pay back or pay out $165 million in bonuses after taking about $175 billion from the U.S. government and the taxpayers.
Well, if you ruled out cursing, it does make it hard to say something that just doesn't sound like a cliche. But what really strikes me is not just the obscenity of it, but that it's the tip of the iceberg. And there's a danger on the AIG stuff that we focus so much just on these bonuses that people forget that they already paid themselves hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses early this year, that this is part and parcel of how the entire financial industry works. And we got to dig a little bit deeper if we're really going to take on this mess and say it's not AIG alone. AIG may be the worst example of what's common practice in America now.
Well, we're now hearing from the head of AIG, Edward Liddy, that he's admitting that mistakes were made at AIG and that it's a little hard to manage such a big corporation. And in fact, those bonuses in the context of what's going on is a little distasteful, he said.
Yeah, but what's even more distasteful, because obviously it's distasteful, is that the entire financial industry in this country has been at the core of how we've sucked more and more money out of the pockets of workers, put it in the handful of the richest people, and the whole thing was based on a fiction that you could just create wealth out of loaning money, then securitizing it and, you know, doing magic tricks. That bubble has burst. What they've done doesn't work. And this is really a critical moment for us to start to redefine what we have to do to take back the economy and make it work. And just as one example, the entire way the banking industry works, from credit cards to overdraft fees, is based on how you force workers deeper and deeper debt and make your money on fees and late payments, not how you make your money on loaning money with the idea that people actually pay it back. The whole industry is based on the idea that people can't make their payments so you can suck more money out of their wallet. So this is the tip of a bigger problem of a finance industry that's built on driving people and the country into debt and paying corporate CEOs extraordinary sums of money.
Well, I want you to talk a little bit more about the impact that these banking bandits and corporate bandits have had on working people, on people whose savings accounts probably have been halved, even if they look like they're the same. Talk a little bit about the impact at that grassroots level.
Well, let's just take credit cards, for example, which is that because workers don't have unions anymore, by and large, because wages have been stagnant, even though productivity has gone up, the way we kept the economy going was to get people to borrow more and more money because they weren't making more money to buy things. So the banks pushed credit cards on people, and then they change the amount of interest you pay, even if you pay on time. They change the dates you pay, and then they figure out a way to sock on more and more fees. So what happens for many workers is that their credit card debt gets deeper and deeper, and they just pay enough each month to stop from losing the card, but they actually never pay off the principal. So it's part of this whole way that banks have built a system that says they make more money if you don't pay on time than if you do pay on time. It's the same in overdraft fees. They have a sophisticated system that says, let's try to target people who can't pay on time, give them as much debt as possible, and then suck as much money out of their wallets as we can get. And it's devastating to somebody who simultaneously has a mortgage they can't afford, they're losing their job. It's part of a cycle of debt that's destroying the country.
And, of course, on the other side of that, the workers are taking the direct hit because they're losing their jobs in record numbers, and we're seeing an unemployment rate skyrocket now.
Well, if you just take Bank of America as an example, is that on the one hand, Ken Lewis, the head of the bank, you know, he made $35 million in 2 years. The average Bank of America teller makes about $22,000 a year. Second, they took $5.2 billion in bonuses at the same and gave that out to Merrill Lynch. At the same time, they took $45 billion in taxpayers' money. Then on top of that, they got money from AIG through the AIG bailout, who then gave I think it's $50 billion, I don't remember the exact number, more money to Bank of America. And then on top of that, so many Bank of America workers don't have health insurance from Bank of America that the state then has to provide it. So taxpayers are subsidizing and paying these guys on multiple levels while they take extraordinary literally hundreds of millions of dollars in salaries. And then the most amazing thing is they then take our taxpayer money and go up on the Hill and lobby against laws like the Employee Free Choice Act, which would let workers form unions again, or lobby against health insurance for families. So they're using our bailout money to lobby against things that would make the economy work for workers. It's really insanity at this point.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Stephen Lerner. He's the assistant to the president of SEIU, and they have organized, along with a number of other groups, a protest that is to take place tomorrow around the country. Some 10,000 people are expected to take to the streets, and it's a protest, I guess, to call for Congress to take action on that employee free choice that you mentioned, on health care and banking reform. You say banking reform to build an economy that works for everyone. I mean, is it possible at this point?
Well, in some ways, it's more possible than it's ever been, because what happened in the past is the banks had people convinced that they were financial wizards and mere mortals couldn't understand what was going on, and that they had all these exotic instruments, and if we interfered, the economy would crash. Instead, they've demonstrated that their business model doesn't work. And so when we talk about banking reform, we're talking about reform from top to bottom. We're saying you have to change the incentive pay at the top that encourages CEOs to take risks that don't make sense because they know they're going to get paid and taxpayers will have to bail it out. But you also have to deal with all the different kinds of products they sell and protect consumers, whether it's be credit cards, whether it's overdraft, whether it's the fees they put on checking accounts without telling people. And then a third leg is you have to deal with the conditions of the workers that work in banks, that bank workers not only make $10 or $11 an hour, they don't have health insurance, but they are then pressured to sell products to consumers that are bad products. They're the ones that are on the front line of being forced into selling predatory loan practices. So we're saying to fix banking, you have to deal with consumer issues through regulation. You need to pass employee free choice and whistleblowers so workers can start to improve their lives. We need to deal with executive compensation and then all the reforms that have to do with transparency and risk and getting rid of banks that are too big to fail, that there's a package of things that need to happen as part of taking back the economy.
And don't we need to start imagining and thinking about and creating structures in which communities hold on to their resources, that their resources are used locally for their schools? Isn't this centralized economy where we continually hear too big to fail? Isn't that part of the problem, that you need to decentralize at a certain level?
I mean, absolutely. We've created this nightmare system where no matter how badly they behave, no matter how big how bad their decisions are, they can turn around and say we're too big. And I heard somebody describe it, we need to get back to vanilla banking instead of fancy banking, which is the idea that you make loans in communities on the assumption that people will pay them back for the purpose of economic development in a community versus how do you free up money to invest in some kind of instrument and bet that you hope won't blow up. So I think that's exactly right. And the key thing about the demonstrations we're doing tomorrow, which we're doing in San Francisco at noon, at Wells Fargo, in L.A. at 4:45, at AIG, we're doing them all over the country, is that we have to make this not just a policy debate, but a debate in the streets, that people have to get out and say, we're angry, we're confronting the folks who got us in this mess, and it's not just about limiting their compensation. It's about changing the system from top to bottom so the economy starts to work for everybody, not just a few guys at the top.
Is there excitement within your union, within SEIU, regarding the fact that we've got a new labor secretary that appears to be from a union background, who has a good deal of sympathy for workers? What's the talk of the town on that?
Well, I think the talk of the town, both, we think it's wonderful that Hilda Solis is labor secretary. She is from a labor family. She is someone that, when we had Justice for Janitors demonstrations, was there with us in the beginning in L.A. But it's not just Hilda Solis. There is a change at every level coming in this country, and an openness to challenging sort of the free market assumptions that anything that makes money for rich guys is going to trickle down to us. And I think all of us are really called to seize this moment to say, this is when we need to talk about how we make grand change and fix the system, not tinker around at the edges. And we think about three starting places, which is one, we have to pass universal health care for everybody in this country. Two, we have to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which is a vehicle for workers to start forming unions again. And third, we've got to fix this financial system, because even if we fix some of the other problems, if these guys keep blowing up a bubble and it bursts, it's going to suck all the money out that people are trying to save right now and, you know, in the middle of this crisis.
And finally, how do you measure how angry people really are? How do you know, based on your work with the union, what level is people's anger? How willing are they to take the next step to speak out?
Hey, I think that's the question of the day, that people are angry. We now need to offer ways that people can express that anger that leads to change, because there's a real danger if people are angry and there aren't concrete steps like the actions we'll do tomorrow, whether it's putting pressure on senators who aren't supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, whether it's other kind of events, that we need to have an escalation of activity in the street and around the country. Let me just give you another example. Citibank, in the middle of all of this, just announced that they're laying off 100, well, they didn't announce it, they were laying off 100 janitors in New York City who clean their buildings. Cisco is laying off half the janitors. Is that people are angry? We now need to tap that anger and say there are solutions, and this is the moment to do it, and we have to focus on what this means for real workers and how, if we take action, it's not just stopping bad things from happening. We can make wonderful things happen.
How can people, if they're interested in learning more about this or participating, how can they learn about it from in their city?
So if you go on the website, takebacktheeconomy.org, it has a listing of every demonstration. It has camera-ready leaflets you can download. We're encouraging people to get three friends and find a bank. And it's got all the information you need. And what we think would be exciting is we've got 140 official demonstrations planned. But what we'll show that people are angry is if people all over the country start saying, I know where a bank is, I know where AIG is, I know where Citibank is, I know where Bank of America is, we're getting some friends and going on our own and saying, enough is enough. These guys have gone too far. It's time to take back the economy. It's time to change the country.
All right. Stephen Lerner, assistant to the president of SEIU, talking about a major protest planned around the country tomorrow. We thank you for the good information and for joining us on Flashpoints.
Great. Thank you very much.